We're here in southwest London, not far from the National Archives, where much of the original material about Brunel is kept. Probably his most famous creation was the Great Western Railway between London and Bristol. In fact, and not a lot of people know this, his original scheme wasn't to take the line into Paddington, but to bring it south of the River Thames, passing near here to a terminus at Vauxhall Bridge. With me is Adrian Vaughan, pencil in hand, ready to do yet more digging into the historical record. But first, Adrian, can you briefly explain what your new book is really all about and why you put it together?
Well, you know, I've been accused of denigrating a great man. And that's not fair, because all I have done, to quote my wife, is read Brunel's letters and look at his diaries. And as a result of reading the man's own words, I came to the conclusion that history hasn't been written from primary sources.
And so nobody else has looked at all this material before?
Mr. Rolt, LTC Rolt, certainly looked at this material, but he was careful to leave out the bits that didn't fit in with the picture, the heroic picture of this fantastically talented engineer who was a genius, and anything that didn't fit into that was simply left out. Rolt's book was written in 1957. I was 16. And I bought a first edition of it because, of course, I've always been a Ryman since I was a little boy. And Brunel is a great figure. And so I bought this book. And Rolt's book certainly always was considered to be the definitive biography of Brunel. But I very much beg to differ on that. Tom Rolt had said that no strikes marred the building of the Great Western Railway. And I thought, that's a very sweeping statement. No strikes at all in 6 years. And what's this about a strike marring something? I didn't like that. It sounded a bit iffy to me. And so I went into the library. I got indexed to the Times. I opened it and at Great Western Railway, and it said, riot, riot, strike, strike. So there were two strikes in 3 months. In 1838. And I thought, well, there you go. Gotcha, Mr. Rolt. That was not right. You just made that up because it sounded good.
And none of this had found its way into the popular imagination and the historical record of what happened with Brunel during that period in the 1830s and 40s.
No, because nobody wanted to believe anything different. Brunel was, I don't say he wasn't a great man. Of course he was a great man, I'm saying he wasn't. But let's get the story straight. And it really annoys me because when I was 16 and I read that book, beautifully written, lovely book, and I believed it. And then when I grow up and start writing my own stuff about the railway, and I discover that I've been actually told fibs. And I just find that irritating. And that's where my very first Brunel book, I've written three books about Brunel now, that's where my first Brunel book came from, when I realised that the whole of Tom Rolt's book is a big rose-tinted spectacle job. And I thought, well, I'm going to have a go at this. And that's when I came down here to Kew and started to read the man's letters. Because I thought, well, if I read what he said, you know, surely that's much better than reading what Tom Rolt said.
OK, well, we'll get stuck into some of that in a yeah, moment.
Yeah.
But first, let's find out what most people know about Brunel and why they think he warrants such a high ranking in the list of greatest Britons. I went to the Didcot Railway Centre in Oxfordshire to talk to some of the volunteer enthusiasts and to the visitors. So who was the greatest Victorian engineer?
Yeah, I think it was Brunel. Yeah. I really do think it was Brunel.
Yeah, we'll go along with that.
We had a talk on the first, was that underground, was that called, Pete, that tunnel?
The
it was going to be an underground railway, wasn't it? The first one under the Thames, it flooded seven times and killed people, didn't it?
That's right, yeah. And what they did, it was to transport goods across the Thames, because the Thames was so congested.
He built it.
Well, his father, it was his father, yeah. Actually.
I think he was a great Victorian. Even that thing on the telly, what Clarkson done, I think he was one of the best we've ever had. I mean, we don't manufacture anything now, do we? So when you go back to them times, he manufactured everything.
And then I remember one time he was playing a trick with his children. He swallowed a penny and he had it stuck in his throat for months. And in the end, he hung himself upside down on a wheel and spun himself, and it apparently flew out. You know, that's the kind of... I think he... you know, he was a bit of a fun chap to be with as well, I think. Apart from, he got... he died young, though, wasn't he? I think through worrying illness.
He thought bigger than anybody else, probably. His broad gauge, the 7-foot gauge track, was wider than anybody else had attempted. I think his reputation's developed over the years. I mean, at the beginning of the Great Western Society, we just wanted to buy a steam engine. There was this castle-class locomotive named Isambard Kingdom Brunel that we used to see running on the main line. I never knew what Isambard Kingdom meant. I thought it was some kind of description of a sort of honour given to the man. I didn't realise it was his name's until much later.
He's left a legacy that's bigger than anybody else's. Brunel had incredible foresight, and he built things that would last. He built his line from London to Bristol, and he had the vision... Well, continuing the line by steamer to North America. I imagine he was fairly dedicated in what he wanted, but he obviously had an imagination as well. I imagine he had a sense of humour when the occasion arose.
Brunel was a great engineer. A lot of people say Stevenson, but me, I say Brunel, because he built so much and such good stuff, and it's still going, a lot of it.
The thing that stands out for me is the picture of him on the winding drum of the Great Eastern. Huge engineering, and this little man stood in front of it with his top hat on and a cigar. I think he was an arrogant man. He had to watch everything that was being done. He was highly critical of his people, but he was a man of great courage. He was at the cutting edge of technology. He tried a lot of things that no one ever tried before.
I think he might have been a bit of a loner. He wasn't one for joining in and mucking in with these people that was doing the job.
I don't know anything about him as a man. I know about his achievements. The thing I think was best is the broad gauge railway. I think Simon is probably right in saying he was a loner in that he didn't publicise himself as a person, he publicised his achievements.
One of the things that sticks in my mind, he actually rode around in what looked like a hearse at the time as his carriage when he was doing the railways. He's a very, very clever man. He sticks in people's minds that he did unusual things at the time.
So there you are, Adrian, the Rotherhithe Tunnel, the broad gauge, the bridges, the steamships. He liked a bit of a laugh, and he rode around in something that looked like a hearse. Are people right about Brunel?
There was a dozen or more people there, and some of the things they said were completely wrong. Other things that they said were perfectly right. I fall back on the thing of just saying that no one doubts that Brunel was a great engineer. What I would question is whether he was the greatest, because those people are talking from a lack of knowledge of other engineers. For instance, they mention Stevenson, that is Robert Stevenson, I suppose. I'm not sure that they meant George. They didn't say. Stevenson and Brunel, the one man they didn't mention because they've never heard of him, was Joseph Locke. Now, Joseph Locke was probably the best engineer that Britain had. Why do I say that? Well, let us look at the purpose of an engineer to a railway company. What is the purpose of an engineer employed by a railway company? Is it to carry out his own pet schemes and spend a lot of other people's money glorifying himself? Or is it to build the railway as well and as cheaply as possible?
And what you're saying is Brunel was the former rather than the latter.
Yeah, Isambard... God, it's so difficult to say it in sort of 10 minutes on the radio. He cost the Great Western Railway an arm and a leg. Now, is that good engineering? He cost them £6.5 million to get from Paddington to Bristol. He said it was going to cost £2.5 million. It cost £6.5 million. It took 2 years longer to build than it should have done because he was so hard on his contractors that no reputable contractor in the end would work for him.
Now, let's come back to that, of the detail about the Great Western in a moment. But in your book, you kind of sketch out his career. And what I want to do is for you to tell us a little bit about his early life to start with, some of the things that people don't know about him and that you've gleaned from some of the letters that you've seen.
In Tom Rolt's book, this is the book that's caused this myth of Brunel to grow up. And this is why people think he was such a totally fantastic man. It's because all they've read is Tom Rolt. And Tom Rolt made things up. He said things that simply were not true. For instance, he said that Isambard had mastered Euclid, that's geometry, folks, at the age of 6. Now, he states that categorically. If you read the letter that Mark Brunel, whom I take it knows more about his son than Rolt does, Mark Brunel wrote a note which Isambard took with him to France when he went to France aged 11 in order to have an education. And in that letter, Mark says he has started Euclid.
At the age of 11 and not 6.
At the age of 6, according to Rolt, he'd mastered it. Never mind started. It's that kind of thing. It's just not true. And that don't half get up my nose. It really does. That's all. I think that history and the correct story is far more important than Brunel or anybody else. Let's have it right.
I think there's something else in that letter that's interesting as well, because Mark Brunel asks that Isambard isn't let anywhere near any cider.
Don't let him drink cider, and make sure he has his rhubarb every day. He has to have tincture of rhubarb every day, and don't let him sit any heavy examinations, because he wasn't a terribly strong little boy. Yes, it does. It's a very nice little letter. The curious thing about that letter is we don't actually know who it was addressed to. You'll forgive my French pronunciation, but it was addressed to mon neveu, my nephew. We've always thought that was Louis Breguet, the great clockmaker, but it doesn't say that on the letter anyhow, and I do like to stick to the text that was written in 1817, you know.
What kind of atmosphere was Brunel brought up in? What kind of a little boy was he?
He was a very bright, jolly little boy. He was a dear little fellow, by all accounts. He was terribly active. He swam in the open sewer that was the River Thames. He boated. He was a good oarsman. He was a great chatterbox. He used to walk along the wall dividing the two gardens in Chelsea and chatter to the next door. Now, he was a very nice little boy. Also, he was a born artist. And he was, because at the age of 6, he did. It's down in Bristol. It's down in the museum on the quayside at Bristol. There is a drawing of a galloping horse which he did when he's 6. And it's jolly good. Anyone would be proud of having drawn that. And he also was a great actor. And I think that the combination of great watercolour artist and great actor might not be the best combination in a man who's trying to build railways. I think perhaps someone with a little more practical sort of... That's all.
It intrigues me what he sounded like when he was a young man, because his mother was English. That's where the kingdom comes from, isn't it?
Yeah.
And his father was French. Would he have grown up with a French accent?
Ah, well, you see, Jeremy Lloyd Pack, that used to do The Vicar of Dibley, he came to see me once because he wanted to know this, because he was going to have to act Brunel. Anyone looking less like Brunel than Jeremy Lloyd Pack couldn't be imagined. But anyhow, and we tried to work this one out and we just didn't know. I mean, that's sheer guesswork. But then again, did he speak a lot to his father? Because in those days, fathers were a bit Olympian. And maybe you didn't involve yourself in happy conversations with your dad. When Brunel is at school at Hove, he was 13 years old, I think, about that, he writes to his mother and asks her to ask his father for a certain piece of drawing equipment. He doesn't ask him himself. And I just think, because in those days, fathers were fathers, you know, and so he asked his mum.
I think the thing that helps you a lot reading the book is the fact that Brunel kept a diary and he wrote copiously.
He did.
His early diaries, before he gets involved with the Great Western, when he's a very young man in his late teens early 20s, intrigue me, because there's quite a little bit in there about his love life.
That piece of the diary, he starts on the left-hand page to write about his love life. And he starts talking about all these girlfriends. And, of course, immediately everybody's ears prick up, you see, and you go down the left-hand page, and then your eyes switch to the right-hand page to continue this story. And we're back to talking about engineering and tunnels and things. What have I done? And it's been razored out ever so neatly. So we've lost at least one other page, if not the backside of that page, just when it's getting interesting about... I mean, he's reeling them all off one after the other. He's using the French mamselle for the abbreviation, mamselle OS, mamselle WB, and there's lots of them. So I can only assume that after he was dead, his wife came across this. Anyhow, the page has been very carefully taken out with a razor. He was a very jolly, artistic, he was an actor, he loved music. He was a very cultured man, and I think that his instincts were in that way. And when he married Mary Horsley, that was a very high society family living out in Kensington, which was almost in the country in those days. Mendelssohn and Joachim, the great violinist, Chopin, all these people went to the Horsleys and played the piano, and Brunel mixed with them. This is a very unusual personality to be a railway engineer.
Now, coming on to his engineering life, the first thing that he actually did, and this is why he became involved with the Great Western and the Bristol party, the Bristol end of the line, was because he entered a competition to design the Clifton Suspension Bridge.
That's right.
Which he won. But you say that when eventually the bridge was built, it wasn't really Brunel's design at all.
That bridge was designed in 1830/31. It was not completed. They hadn't even finished the two towers that hold up the suspension chains. They were only stumps. What was finished was that big red brick abutment on the leeward side, the far side away from Clifton. That was finished. Two stumps of towers. That's all that was done. Ran out of money at 1836. So when he died, the engineering establishment of Britain wished to pay their respects to a great engineer.
And this is the late 1850s, yeah. 1860s.
He died in September the 15th, 1859. So in 1860, so after Christmas, the engineering establishment said, what are we going to do to commemorate Mr. Brunel, a great engineer? Nobody's saying he wasn't a great engineer, and I'm certainly not saying he wasn't a great engineer. So they said, well, let's finish his bridge for him. So then they come to look at the designs. Now, my evidence for saying this is the paper that was read to the Institution of Civil Engineers, the greatest institution of civil engineering in the world. And they describe what was wrong with Isambard's bridge. In general principles, you are not going to erect a suspension bridge to a 30-year-old design. You're just not going to, because there must have been improvements in technology since he designed the bridge. And in detail, these two men, William Barlow, who went on to design the Forth Bridge, he also designed St Pancras Station, William Barlow and Sir John Hawkshaw, who was a contemporary of Brunel's, they found that Brunel's bridge was much too flexible, much too floppy for a suspension bridge. What I object to is being told that that bridge, there is a large cast iron plate on the Clifton Tower, which states categorically that this bridge was designed by Mr. Brunel. Well, it wasn't. And we ought to give the honour of designing the bridge to the people who designed it. Now, surely that's not asking too much, is it?
Do you think that if they'd have put up Brunel's really original design and kept to it, it would have stood?
Well, it would not have stood. And the men, Barlow and Hawkshaw's description, what they did was to describe what they did, and their words were, we had to vary and rearrange the design, which was a polite way of saying they made a new design.
Let's come on to the railway again, because the book is really all about the railway, and you're addressing some of the things about the railway that you think that Rolt didn't tell the truth about. Mm. Let's talk about the track a little bit, because everybody knows or thinks they know about what they call the broad gauge. Yeah. That was the 7-foot gauge. And some people now say that if we'd have had the 7-foot gauge all along and not what we call the standard gauge, then we'd have had a much better railway now. You seem to be suggesting that there were all sorts of problems with the broad gauge.
He wanted big wheels. The larger the diameter of the wheels on the carriages, the less friction there is in the axle bearing, and therefore the less fuel you require to drag the carriages along the track, because they've got big wheels, less friction. So if he's going to have the wheels coming up outside the body of the carriages, he can't have a 4-foot-8 gauge. There'll be no floor space. So he makes it 7 foot. Now, it's no good arguing. Brunel said that. Brunel wrote that on the 15th of September, 1835. I think that's the exact date. That is what he wrote to his directors. I want to have big wheels. This will reduce friction, and therefore I will need to have 7-foot wide rails in order to fit some sort of width to the carriages. Now, in the course of writing The Intemperate Engineer, I was going into all this and poking around on Google and whatnot. I thought, I know, instead of having great big wheels, why don't you have ball races? When were ball races invented? So you Google roller bearings, and loads of stuff come up, people trying to flog your roller bearings. But amongst it all, in 1797, a chap called Philip Vaughan, no relation, Philip Vaughan invented the ball race, and it's patented. Now, Isambard is credited by Mr. Rolt of being a man who always kept abreast of all technological development. Well, why didn't he know about ball races? Why not just put ball races and never mind big wheels and having a gauge that no one else's trains can run on? I mean, do you see? I don't think that was terribly clever. And he was going on. The broad gauge was made on a false assumption about this friction. He then put his rails 7 feet apart, but he made the bridges the same height above the track as Robert Stephenson's standard gauge.
So he couldn't have had big trains anyway?
No, you couldn't have done. I don't say anything about Brunel that I can't prove from his own letters.
And another thing about the track that you've found out is that he had what they call longitudinal timbers. Instead of the sleepers being
crossways,
they were along the length of the track, and he had this system where he put poles into the ground, and then the carriages went along the railway rather like a roller coaster.
Well, in The Intemperate Engineer, I have published his justification for making this crazy track. He said, what we need is a track that will never move. It is absolutely rigid. So he was going to drive. He did drive. They were the size of telegraph poles, 20 feet long, hammered down into the ground. And in the letter in the book, it actually says, we have tried out the track at West Drayton. We laid 1.5 miles of it. And it doesn't move, and it will not move. I've created this perfect track. He then goes on to say, this test was carried out in January during a hard frost. Well, the track was frozen to the ground. And you think, Izzy, what are you talking about, man? I mean, this is crazy stuff. And between the piles, the weight of the locomotive would press the track into the ground. At the piles, it would be held up. And, of course, that is where you got this roller coaster effect.
It sounds from what you've found out that he made his name by experimenting with other people's money.
Oh, yeah. The famous saying is, Mr. Brunel learned to shave on the chins of the shareholders. And I don't think that that's an engineer's job is not to spend the shareholders' money to try out fancy ideas.
He must have been a pretty astute politician, though, to stay in the business, so to speak, when he did make some pretty glorious mistakes.
He made some glorious mistakes, but he was very good at charming people, and he had them in his spell. He really did. But of course, he did make this amazing railway from London to Bristol. The modern trains can run over it at 125 miles an hour and they haven't had to alter a single curve. This is my drive. It is not to denigrate Brunel, but it's to say, look, him and half a dozen others. He wasn't the only guy, and there's a lot of stuff said about him that isn't true, and there's a lot of stuff that Brunel did which was very silly.